Part 1. The Prosper Tear. Chapter 1. October 10, 1989. Key West, Florida. The blimp hung motionless in the tropical air, poised and tranquil, like a fish suspended in an aquarium. Her bow nudged against a yellow mooring mast as she balanced daintily on a single landing wheel. She was a tired-looking old airship. Her once silver skin had wrinkled and turned white and was spotted by numerous patches. The gondola, the control car that hung beneath her belly, wore an antique boat-like look, and its glass windows were yellowed with age. Only her two 200-horsepower Wright whirlwind engines appeared new, having been carefully restored to pristine condition. Unlike her younger sister ships that plied the skies above football stadiums, her gas-tight envelope was made from aluminum with riveted seams instead of rubber-coated polyester and was supported by 12 circular frames like the back of a fish. Her cigar shape was 149 feet in length and held 200,000 cubic feet of helium, and if no headwinds attacked her rotund nose, she could barrel through the clouds at 62 miles an hour. Her original designation was ZMC-2, Zeppelin Metal Clad No. 2, and she had been constructed in Detroit and turned over to the United States Navy in 1929. Unlike most airships with four massive stabilizing fins, she sported eight small fins on her tapered tail. Very advanced for her era, she had given solid and dependable service until 1942. When she was dismantled and forgotten. For 47 years, the ZMC-2 languished in an abandoned hangar along the runway of a deserted naval air station near Key West, Florida. Then, in 1988, the property was sold by the government to a financial conglomerate headed by a wealthy publisher, Raymond LeBaron, who intended to develop it as a resort. Shortly after arriving from his corporate headquarters in Chicago to inspect the newly purchased naval base, LeBaron stumbled onto the dusty and corroded remains of the ZMC-2 and became intrigued. Charging it off to promotion, he had the old, lighter-than-air craft reassembled and the engines rebuilt, calling her the Prosper Tear, after the business magazine that was the base of his financial empire, and emblazoning the name in huge red letters on the side of the envelope. LeBaron learned to fly the Prosper Tear, mastering the fickle moods of the craft and the constant adjustments required to maintain steady flight under the capricious nature of the wind. There was no autopilot to relieve the chore of dipping the bow against a sudden gust and lifting it when the breeze slackened. The near-neutral buoyancy varied greatly with the atmosphere. Residue from a light rain could add hundreds of pounds to the blimp's vast skin, decreasing her ability to lift, while dry air blowing down from the northwest forced the pilot to fight the craft's insistence on rising to an undesired altitude. LeBaron reveled in the challenge. The exhilaration of second-guessing the moods of the antique gas bag and wrestling with her aerodynamic whims far exceeded any enjoyment he received from flying any of the five jet aircraft belonging to his corporate holdings. He sneaked away from the boardroom at every opportunity to travel to Key West so he could island hop around the Caribbean. The Prosper Tear soon became a familiar sight over the Bahama Islands. A native worker, laboring in a sugarcane field, looked up at the blimp and promptly described her as a little pig running backwards. LeBaron, however, like most entrepreneurs of the power elite, suffered from a restless mind and a driving urge to tackle a new project lying over the next hill. After nearly a year, his interest in the old blimp began to wane. Then one evening, in a waterfront saloon, he met an old beach rat by the name of Buck Caesar, who operated a backwater salvage company with the grandiloquent title Exotic Artifact Ventures, Incorporated. During a conversation over several rounds of iced rum, Caesar spoke the magic word that has fired the human mind into insanity for 5,000 years and probably caused more grief than half the wars: treasure. After listening to Caesar spin tales of Spanish galleons littering the waters of the Caribbean, their cargoes of gold and silver mingled with the coral. Even a shrewd financial manipulator with the acute business sense of LeBaron was hooked. With a handshake, they formed a partnership. LeBaron's interest in the Prospertier was revived. The blimp made a perfect platform for spotting potential shipwreck sites from the air. Airplanes moved too fast for aerial survey, while helicopters had a limited flying time and churned up the surface of the water with wash from their rotor blades. The blimp could remain airborne for 2 days and cruise at a walk. From an altitude of 400 feet, the straight lines of a man-made object could be detected by a sharp eye 100 feet beneath a calm and clear sea. Dawn was crawling over the Florida Straits as the 10-man ground crew assembled around the Prospertier and began a pre-flight inspection. The new sun caught the huge envelope covered by morning dew, giving off an iridescent effect like that from a soap bubble. The blimp stood in the center of a concrete runway whose expansion cracks were lined with weeds. A slight breeze blew in from the straits, and she swung around the mooring mast until her bulbous nose faced into it. Most of the ground crew were young, deeply tanned, and casually dressed in an assortment of shorts, bathing suits, and denim cutoffs. They took scant notice as a Cadillac stretch limousine drove across the runway and stopped at the large truck that served as the blimp's repair shop, crew chief's office, and communications room. The chauffeur opened the door and LeBaron unlimbered from the rear seat, followed by Buck Caesar, who immediately made for the blimp's gondola with a roll of nautical charts tucked under one arm. LeBaron, looking a very trim and healthy 65, towered above everyone at 6'7". His eyes were the color of light oak, the graying hair combed just so, and he possessed the distant, preoccupied gaze of a man whose thoughts were several hours in the future. He bent down and spoke for a few moments to an attractive woman who leaned from the car. He kissed her lightly on the cheek, closed the car door, and began walking toward the Prospertier. The crew chief, a studious-looking man wearing a spotless white shop coat, came over and shook LeBaron's outstretched hand. "Fuel tanks are topped off, Mr. LeBaron. The pre-flight checklist is completed. How's the buoyancy?" "You'll have to adjust for an extra 500 pounds from the dampness." LeBaron nodded thoughtfully. "She'll lighten in the heat of the day. The controls should feel more responsive. The elevator cables were showing signs of rust, so I had them replaced." "What's the weather look like?" "Low scattered clouds most of the day. Little chance of rain. You'll be bucking a 5-mile-an-hour headwind from the southeast on the way out." "And a tailwind on the return trip. I prefer that." "Same radio frequency as the last trip?" "Yes, we'll report our position and condition using normal voice communication every half hour. If we spot a promising target, we'll transmit in code." The crew chief nodded. "Understood." Without further conversation, LeBaron climbed the ladder to the gondola and settled in the pilot seat. He was joined by his co-pilot, Joe Cavilla, a 60-year-old, sad-eyed, dour individual who seldom opened his mouth except to yawn or sneeze. His family had immigrated to America from Brazil when he was 16, and he had joined the Navy, flying blimps until the last airship unit was formally disbanded in 1964. Cavilla had simply showed up one day, impressed LeBaron with his expertise in lighter-than-aircraft, and was hired. The third member of the crew was Buck Caesar. He wore a constant smile on a gentle, middle-aged face that had the texture of cowhide, but his gaze was shrewd, and the body held the firmness of a boxer. He sat hunched over a small table contemplating his charts, drawing a series of squares near a sector of the Bahama Channel. Blue smoke burst from the exhaust stacks as LeBaron turned over the engines. The ground crew untied a number of canvas sacks containing ballast shot from the gondola. One crewman, the butterfly catcher, held up a windsock on a long pole so LeBaron could note the exact direction of the wind. LeBaron gave a hand signal to the crew chief. A wooden chock was pulled from the landing wheel, the nose coupling was released from the mooring mast, and the men holding the bow ropes heaved to one side and let go. When the airship was free and clear of the mast, LeBaron eased the throttles forward and spun the large elevator wheel next to his seat. The Prospertier pointed her comic opera snout upward at a 50-degree angle and slowly drove into the sky. The ground crew watched until the huge airship gradually faded from view over the blue-green waters of the Straits. Then their interest turned briefly to the limousine and the vague feminine shape behind the tinted windows. Jessie LeBaron shared her husband's passion for outdoor adventure, but she was an orderly woman who preferred organizing charity balls and political fundraisers over a time-wasting hunt for dubious treasure. Vibrant and bouncy, with a mouth that had a repertory of a dozen different smiles, she was 6 months past 50, but looked closer to 37. Jessie was slightly heavy-bodied but firm. Her facial skin was creamy smooth, and she had allowed her hair to turn a natural salt and pepper. The eyes were large and dark and bore no trace of the blank look usually left by plastic surgery. When she could no longer see the blimp, Jessie spoke into the limousine's intercom. "Angelo, please drive back to the hotel." The chauffeur, a somber Cuban with the etched face of a postage stamp engraving, touched two fingers to the brim of his cap and nodded. The ground crew watched the long Cadillac turn and head through the deserted front gate of the former naval base. Then someone produced a volleyball. Quickly, they drew out the boundaries and set up a net. After choosing up sides, they began batting the ball back and forth to fight the boredom of waiting. Inside the air-conditioned truck, the crew chief and a radio operator acknowledged and recorded the reports from the blimp. LeBaron religiously transmitted every 30 minutes, never varying more than a few seconds, describing his approximate position, any changes in weather, and vessels passing below. Then, at 2:30 in the afternoon, the report stopped. The radio operator tried to raise the Prospertier, but there was no response. 5:00 came and went with still no word. Outside, the ground crew wearily ceased their play and crowded around the door to the radio compartment as the uneasiness inside began to grow. At 6:00, with no sign of the blimp over the sea, the crew chief put in a call to the Coast Guard. What no one knew, or possibly suspected, was that Raymond LeBaron and his friends on board the Prospertier had vanished in a mystery that went far beyond any mere treasure hunt.